See, I saw Spalding Gray perform in Philadelphia, which is hard to imagine. There's very little life in Philadelphia. They try to exterminate it as quickly as it sprouts. But they actually came through Philly at the one kind of little theater you might see something like that at. And The Painted Bride, I think? My God, I think I remember that. It was called The Painted Bride. But one of the things I remember about it is coming a little late, a bunch of people sitting on the floor in the front and actually bringing a six-pack in. I actually just remember sitting there in this performance space drinking a six-pack watching Spalding Gray do his shtick. Can you imagine that now? Are you allowed to consume anywhere like that?
Yes. All street of speakeasy.
Oh, I heard you talking about this. And they show movies or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice thing. It's a nice thing. But I bet they're kind of grubby. No, they're nice. It was like the last moment of like a culture that actually enjoyed itself a little bit before we plummeted into this abyss of asceticism through slavery to capitalism. Okay. So let's go back to our hero here, who is the revolutionary, who will liberate us from the constraints of late-stage capitalism. Where were we? 132. Right. What we think of as our ego is a defensive reaction, just as the symptoms of an illness are the body's reaction to an invading organism. Again, what's so nice here, one thing I've kind of asked us all along, right, by coming in the very first day and saying, everything is an argument. What I've suggested to you is that everything is kind of alien. What I've wanted you to kind of do is defamiliarize everything and then relearn it. Right? To try to make absolutely everything you take for granted unfamiliar. My goal is to turn you into aliens in your own world. I want you to take nothing for granted. Right? From the clothes you wear, from the stories you tell yourself about yourself, to the shape of the classroom, to the fact that your chairs do what they do. I want everything to be an argument, everything to kind of come at you freshly, unfamiliarly. And that means becoming an alien in your own world. And one thing Burroughs performs here is this kind of this move to what I call, I steal the notion of post-humanity, overcoming the human. Right. So rather than thinking of yourself as this inviolate individual, right, who sits atop of the food chain and has conquered the planet, you think of yourself rather as an organism amidst organisms. Or even more dramatically, you consider yourself stuff amidst stuff. Right? What happens when you begin breaking down the distinction between you and a chair? Right? In some sense, if you just examine everything as an argument, you look at how things go, then, you know, fundamentally as a material, there's no real difference between you and a chair. There is in performance, but not categorically. Right? And so what Burroughs kind of asks us again here to do is to think of ourselves as an organism. Right? Nietzsche asks us to a little bit too, to alienate ourselves, to make ourselves alien to our own world. He turned us into these clever beasts on a faraway planet. Right? McLuhan, the same thing, tried to defamiliarize the book. Right? He tried to expose the things that are taken most for granted to be something you, in fact, need to reckon. Right? So here's, again, Burroughs, like Nietzsche, turning the ego, the self, into the symptom of a disease. Right? It's a kind of radical defamiliarization. This session no one even comes to my class. It should be full. I could guess, but nobody else wants to come. So our beloved ego, rising from the rotten weeds of lust and fear and anger, has no more continuity than a fever sweat. It's so beautiful, man. It's so nasty. Right? We've seen this kind of displacement of the ego from Nietzsche and Roland Barthes. But here you see it at its most as kind of nasty, right? It's most kind of disdainful, right? Our beloved ego arising from the rotten weeds of lust and fear and anger. There is no ego, only a shifting process, unreal as the cities of the odor eaters that dissolve in rain. Right? Like Nietzsche, for Burroughs, the self is just this flux, is this great multiplicity. And like Nietzsche's essay, this essay is riddled, punctuated, is a chorus of voices. There's a great multiplicity of voices constantly speaking at these impossible angles. So let us continue. A moment's introspection will demonstrate that we are not the same as we were a year ago, a week ago. This opens many doors. Like Nietzsche, like Barthes, Burroughs finds liberation, freedom, in the fact that he's not an ego. Right? The ego becomes this constraining thing, this damnation. By opening yourself up to the plays of language, to the plays of the flux, to the kind of infinite flow of the universe, you become multiplied, proliferated. Right? You become liberated. Yes, indeed. Okay, this happens all the time. You think of someone and you can hear his voice in your throat, feel his face in yours, his eyes looking at you. You notice this happens with some people more than others. Right? Let's face it, you are other people and other people are you. The illusion of a separate, inviolable identity limits your perception and confines you in time. You live in other people and other people live in you. Visiting, we call it, and of course it's ever so much easier with one's clones. Right? Anyway, we'll keep going. I first heard about, I thought it was a fruitful concept. I was amazed at the outcry, this good thing, not only from the men of the cloth, but from scientists who had thought of this thing, right? Who is this terrifying to? Who is cloning terrifying to? Who's so scared of it? The weak, the scared, the angry. What Burroughs does, like Nietzsche does, he says, you know what? There's no such thing as a neutral claim to knowledge, right? Every claim to knowledge is an argument, has a position, but it also has a life. It is a life lived. Right? And so what Burroughs and Nietzsche both try to do is show you the person of someone who believes these things. Right? So he shows the scientist as this weak, petty little man, Nietzsche, right, in his essay, cowering down next to the tower of knowledge, trying to protect himself. Right? Here's Burroughs showing us those who cling to the ego, right, against cloning, as again, petty, stupid, resentful, ill-constituted people. Because there's no such thing as just a pure fact. There's a life that makes claims to facts. And that life, according to Burroughs, is what's ugly. It's that life that you need to assess. Yeah. It's sort of, you know, what I'm trying to argue through this essay is sort of what's at stake in all this nonsense I've been teaching you over the semester. The what's at stake is the life led. Right? It's not just claims to knowledge, it's not just the academy, it's not just knowing how to parse an argument, but what's at stake is the life you lead. Are you weak? Are you angry? Are you resentful? Are you petty and stupid? Or are you open to the free play of life? Do you seek to multiply life? Do you seek health and vitality and exuberance and proliferation? Or do you seek closure and resentment and shutting shit down like every fucking asshole on this planet? Right? Too many scientists seem to be ignorant of the most rudimentary spiritual concepts. They tend to be suspicious, bristly, paranoid type people with huge egos. They push around like some elephantitis victim with his distended testicles in a wheelbarrow, terrified, no doubt, that some skulking ingrate of a clone student will sneak into his very brain and steal his genius work. Right? It's hilarious. Right? He's following through a gesture, again, we saw in Nietzsche, of inhabiting an idea as a life. He turns an idea and he says that he doesn't really separate an idea from a life. Right? In a book by Deleuze and Guattari, they'll talk about conceptual persona. Right? You think about a character always as a person who's separate from their ideas. But what we've been doing in this class is really weaving these two things together, arguing that the life led and the things claimed can't be separated. Right? The two are intimately intertwined. And so what Burroughs deploys a lot in this essay is these characters as ideas. This life lived that is an idea. So here's the idea of the scientist who's against cloning, but he's also a character. You can't separate the two. You can't separate the position, the argument, from the particular life. The life that has a look, that has a smell, that has a body, that has huge testicles in a wheelbarrow. The unfairness of it brings tears to his eyes as he peers anxiously through his bifocals. He is reading a book in his image by David Rorvik. So Burroughs now introduces this book, right? And he gives you a little bit of the plot of the book. And you jump down. In the last paragraph, says, a group of identical youths stand on a rocky point overlooking a valley. One farts. No one smiles or alters his expression. One points. In a blur of movements, all in perfect sync, they gather their packs and rifles and move out. I ask you, in what voice? Who's speaking right there? This text is so bizarre in its constant conjuring of voices that seem even to exceed Burroughs. Right? It's not just that Burroughs deploys these voices as these clean concepts. He almost invites a kind of madness to his text to the point at which you have no idea who's speaking. I don't think he has any idea who's speaking. Right? That perhaps to be a keen writer is in fact to be possessed by voices you don't know or control. You wonder where they came from. They just go down on the page. You transcribe the madness, right? The unassignable madness. So rather than the artist being someone who controls his domain, he's precisely someone who doesn't control his domain. And it's a very different image. So I ask you, just rhetorically, right? If you're examining this essay, who's speaking here? Is this the book? Is this Burroughs? What is happening in this paragraph? It's completely insane. Are you with me on that? Right? If you had to ascribe voice to this one paragraph, what could you possibly say? Put the page. A close-up as they move down a mountain trail shows that something is lacking in these faces, something that we are accustomed to see. The absence is as jarring as if the faces lacked a mouth or a nose. There is no face prepared to meet the faces that it meets, no self-image, no need to impress or assert. They blend into the landscape like picture puzzle faces. What's the first thing you notice? What's about this paragraph?
It's a movie.
One thing I taught a class on films once in the image. And the last text of that class was a book by Burroughs in which I argued it was a movie. That I'm not sure all things that look like books are in fact books. And I'm not sure all things that we call movies are in fact movies. I think Steven Spielberg makes movies. You think he makes movies. He certainly likes celluloid, but he's a storyteller. He tells stories. Stories are a product of the book. They move from left to right. They go from point A to point B. Movies have no need to go from point A to point B. That's something that comes from the book. That's an old medium. The whole notion of a story in a film is really alien to film itself. A camera doesn't know anything about story. Right? Film has no need to go in one direction. It doesn't even need to have one screen. I've told you of my friend who makes movies that have anywhere from 2 to like 24 screens, all playing simultaneously. And there's no need for one screen. Where does that come from? That comes from the page, one page. So then are we always sure that all books are books? I try to argue that McLuhan creates an acoustic space. I argue that Burroughs here, as I said on the first day, doesn't write in words. He deploys images. He works with images. He works with gesture. He breaks the word. He folds the word up into an image. And what's nice about an image is that it can say many, many, many things at once. And it's sort of like the pun. The pun can say a couple things at once. But an image can speak so ambivalently, so ambiguously, so multiply all at once. Right? I take a shot of this room. Think how many things are in that picture. All your faces. And if I looked at each face, say Lex is falling asleep, Anna's actually interested, right? These two are flirting, right? There's a whole weird scene. Sasha's over there waving. Like, there's a whole scene, right, of so many complex things going on. It's not univocal. How could I possibly tell you all those things at once? Right? How could I write that down? It would take so long to list all the different things that are going on in here, all the different trajectories, but of one picture. All of a sudden, I have this great multiplicity all at once. And I'd argue that Burroughs seeks to turn the word into image. And so just in this paragraph, he tells us a close-up. Look at how much is going on here. All of a sudden, this whole deployment of clones, the absence, right? He says, there is no face prepared to meet the face that it meets. No self-image. Right? It's so complicated. These people bland. You don't even know how he feels about this, right? There's such a great ambiguity of how he feels, right? Of what's happening here. The image has such a taste for the ambiguous and the ambivalent and the multiple. It relishes it in a way the word doesn't really want it. The word wants a kind of conceptual rigor, and that's what you learn to do in the academy. give your words very precise meanings.
Right.
But Burroughs is here, is multiplying it, exploding it, proliferating. Does that make some sense, this paragraph? Right. It's this very strange image of these faces, these presumably they're clones. Is he? You think he's happy about clones? You think he's not happy about clones? What's his, how does he feel about this? What is his stance on this? Right. I've said in day one, being for or against something is such an uninteresting way to feel about a position. Are you ever just for or against something? You for or against gun control? Does that make any sense? Yes, I'm for gun control. Yeah, but you know, when a guy sticks a gun in my face, I want to stick one back in his face. Or I want the cop to have one to shoot the guy's head off. Right? I feel ambiguously about guns. For the most part, they scare the shit out of me. Right? But doesn't mean, the point is you feel multiple ways about multiple things. Right? Very rare that you just have one stance. So here's Burroughs talking about this thing, cloning. And he's just, yes, we should clone. And he's like, what a fruitful concept. Let's check it out. Let's play with it. Let's explore it. Kind of like the idea. What will happen? In a way, he becomes the true scientist. And it's why this thing has a voice of science. That if you imagine the true scientist as the kind of radical empiricist, as the person who just says, what is the world made of? I don't know beforehand. Isn't that kind of how we imagine the scientist at his best? He comes to the world and says, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm curious. Right? At some point, you imagine the scientist is actually born of a kind of radical curiosity and a willingness to say, I don't know what's going to happen. Right? I'm interested in lemurs, but I don't know squat about lemurs. So I'm going to spend the next 10 years of my life living with lemurs, and then maybe I'll know something about lemurs. It's kind of beautiful and completely insane. Right? That becomes the scientist as in a way, the artist. Or as Burroughs here, or as the free intellect, who doesn't know what will come. Imagine the scientist as a man of ignorance rather than a man of knowledge. In a way, that is the true scientist. And that's why Burroughs' piece functions almost like a kind of science. Right? Because science at some point is the free intellect. If you imagine science as not the confirmation of a columbarium of concepts, not as a consummation or confirmation of preformed knowledge, but as a kind of empiricism. Do we know what this word means, empiricism? That's kind of a popular word, right? It means looking at the world as it happens. The empiricist becomes a phenomenologist, starts looking at how things happen, the logic and behavior of things happening, rather than confirming the known through what's happening. Does that make some sense? Right, we talked about the scientist with Nietzsche, and, you know, right, that at some point here's the truth, some fact, right? Lemurs are nocturnal. Is that true? No, lemurs are probably diurnal. Right, because you go to the zoo and they're always out in the day. Right, so lemurs are diurnal. Does anyone know? It's the only thing I remember from my, I had to take a physical anthropology class as an undergraduate to pass, you know, one of the requirements, science requirements. All I remember is I was supposed to memorize whether the lemur was diurnal or nocturnal. And I was like, this is insane. I refuse to take this exam. I refuse to memorize that fact. I didn't do very well in that class. But they got little eyes, right? They're diurnal. All right. So then I go out in the field and I look for the lemur. Right? I got really long tails, right? And I try to confirm that this is true. Right? Or I try to prove that it's not true. They're nocturnal. But either way, I'm always speaking back to a truth. That's one vision of science that Nietzsche poo-pooed and that we're poo-pooing here. Right? What if I say, I don't know squat about lemurs. I just saw this weird looking, I don't even know that a lemur's a lemur. What defines a lemur? They look an awful lot like raccoons, I got to tell you. So, you know, you go out to study lemurs, next thing you know, you got this whole elaborate bestiary of animals, right, that kind of resemble the lemur. Lemurs kind of stripes its way to the zebra, and you get this whole elaborate behavioral schema, right? Who knows what will come? Who knows? Imagine that scientist who says, I don't know what's going to happen. What a beautiful vision. So here's Burroughs talking about the cloning. He doesn't know what's going to happen. He doesn't know. But he's game. Bring it on. Yeah.
I just thought you should know that they're both black and white.
That's why I can't remember. Thank you very much. Long live the internet. The internet knows many, many things. So what's this point? The next paragraph. In the book, Max refrains and settles down to watch his little clone grow. Why can't I speak? He sits down to watch his little clone grow. In my fictional extension, he is more venturesome. It's such a great moment. He takes up this book of fiction. He then extends it, right? The fictional extension of it is more venturesome. Goes to is adventure, is more, he's going to make more stuff, is going to go forward more. It be more exploratory. But this is so strange. He takes up a book of fiction, fictionally extends it as his way of exploring a scientific idea and a moral position. Right? Again, he's totally shifted the relationship between science and literature. Always already. He's not even, you know, Nietzsche talks about it. Burroughs doesn't talk about it. He just does it. Right? So I love this rewriting of a voice. Now look at the play of voices that happen. As he fictionally extends this guy's essay, this guy's book, who's speaking? Look at the next paragraph. At this point, I was engaged in another assignment which took me away for a year. Who's speaking? Whose eye is that? Right? Try to map that eye. Just try to map it. It would be insane. Right? Is it Burroughs? Is it Burroughs' version of this character Darwin? Is it his version of this character Darwin in this guy's what's the guy's book? What's the name of the guy who wrote the book?
David Warbeck.
Whose eye is that? Yeah. It's beautiful, right? There is a kind of cloning. There, Burroughs quite explicitly performs his argument about about immortality, that immortality is mutation. It's not inhabiting another body, but it's changing, adapting, becoming something absolutely different. That's what he argues at the end, is immortality. Immortality is adaptability. Being able to adapt to radically different environments will make you immortal. Right? If you could adapt to not having a body, well, you could live forever, right? If your body dies, it's adapting to fundamentally new conditions. Right? So here he's taking the eye, which is precisely what's at stake in immortality. What happens to the eye? This word eye, this person eye. Where is it located? And here he's mutated it. He's willed a kind of mutation onto it. And thereby, in a sense, made it immortal, according to his own argument. You with me on this? Okay. He's literally taken up someone else's book and he's rewriting it in front of us, introducing a mutation. He's saying, well, here's this book, but let's change it. Let's make it replicate itself, but with difference. And of course, replication with difference is the definition of evolution. Right? Literally. That's how things change. Right? Everything changes a little bit. You repeat yourself over and over, but a little bit of change happens. Right? When the little person came out of my wife, it's not me, it's not her, he's a little bit different. There's always necessarily a little bit of mutation. That's the nature of the beast. Mutations can be more or less radical. Sasha. Absolutely. That's what's hilarious about his argument, right? Is immortality for him his premise? You have to shift the argument. What becomes of immortality when it's no longer dependent on the ego? When it's no longer me living forever? If there's no me, then what is immortality? Right. That's exactly it. Thank you so much. Right. Okay. So we get again this hilarious, demented beginning here. At this point, I was engaged. When I returned, Roberto, the chauffeur, met me at the airport with new clothes and an expensive wristwatch. What's he talking about here? Right? He gets to this weird facility, somewhere in clerical garb and toning, interfering with the designs of the Creator. Each of us has a right to a special, unique relation, right, with the Creator. Others were up as doddering scientists, meandering in senile dementia. A hideous scientist croaks out like some misshapen toad. Right? And then he realizes that the boys are mocking the opponents of cloning. Talk about a complex play of voices here. Right? Within a story that's a fictionalization of another story are these characters who are pretending to mock cloning. It's sort of like, again, the beginning of Bart's essay on the death of the author, where he quotes Balzac. Right? And it's a character who's a castrato, who's pretending to be a woman. It's such an involution of voices. You can't possibly locate where an I would be. Right? Here's such a complicated play of voices. Whose voice is this? That's mocking cloning. It's like it's so hilariously involuted, convoluted. So talk about turtles all the way down. Right? Talk about no origin. Right? He's completely eradicated any possibility of an origin for these voices. They're not like a shift of something that's recognizable. At this point, all assignation of responsibility or authorship has been so thoroughly and always already eradicated. Does that make sense? The thought of human non-selflessness is terrifying, screeches a snippy old savant. He ducks into his study and recoils in horror. A replica of himself is sitting at his desk going through his notes. I realize that the boys are mocking the opponents of cloning. At this point, Max comes in with Dr. Darwin. Darwin is a changed man. Gone are his petulance and hesitation, his prickly ego. He glows with health and confidence. The boys greet him boisterously. What Burroughs is setting up here, as Nietzsche did, is a criteria, is a kind of ethics, is a kind of way to make sense of the world, but one that's not premised on true. Right? It's not are you true or not. It's are you healthy or not. Are you a petulant little shithead, or are you confident and you know, self-contained while being multiple, right, and not an uptight prick, right? Are you a vampire, or are you a Johnson? Right, that's what it comes down to for Burroughs. Are you a vampire? Do you suck life away? Do you eat at other people, take their vitality? Or are you a Johnson? You're a mensch. You take care of your own. You reach out once in a while, take care of someone else if they're in trouble. Right? For Nietzsche, it was, are you this free intellect? Do you want to make more of the world? Or do you want to constantly limit the flow of the world? It's not a question of true or false. It's a question of health and sickness, of adding to the world or taking away from the world. That's what's at stake. Right? That's what all of these authors, all of these writers have kind of thrown down to us. Right? What do you do? What life do you lead? Do you make life or do you kill life? How many killed today, Doc? Right? So also we get this, again, this ridiculously hilarious, elaborate narrative. People are speaking. I don't even know who's speaking here. Yippee, a boy screams, I'm cloned. And he got clones popping out. I call them poppies. Which, again, is another pun where he's weaving together so many different things. Heroin, cloning, science. And Max bellows with laughter, I am not mad, nor is this ego gone berserk. On the contrary, cloning is the end of the ego. For the first time, the spirit of man will be able to separate itself from the human machine, to see it and use it as a machine. He is no longer identified with one special me machine. The human organism has become an artifact you can use like a plane or a space capsule. And again, what's beautiful about this very strange argument is he kind of it looks like he's duplicating the Christian dichotomy of body and soul, of spirit and body. But it's so much stranger because he doesn't have a soul. Right? In his great book I've told you all to read, maybe somebody will actually read, The Western Lands. Read The Western Lands. Right? At the very beginning of it, he talks about the Egyptian cosmology. Has like 14 souls, 11 souls, something like that, 7 souls. And he just goes through all the different souls that we have. You don't have one soul, you got lots of souls, according to Burroughs. And what's really cool about The Western Lands is that all the different souls map to him onto different people in the production of a movie. Right? So your whole being is a movie that's constantly being made by this collective authorship. It's really good. Very funny, very smart. All right. So then there's this break, and this weird little fiction within this fiction within this fiction is over, presumably, right? This weird space break in the page. And you get the beautiful, the fundamental cry of the true scientist, of the empiricist, right? John Giono wondered if maybe a clone of a clone of a clone would just phase out into white noise like copies of a tape. As Count Korzybski used to say, I don't know, let's see. That is the empirical scientist's call. I don't know. Let's see. Let's see what happens. I don't know yet. Right? Rather than confirming something, I go to it. Yeah, okay. Very, very nice. Exactly, right? It's exactly what Burroughs is doing. He takes an idea and he explores it. It's a kind of empiricism. It's an empiricism with fiction, with literature, with ideas, with images. Let's follow it out. Let's see what happens. That was great. Yeah. So this whole essay is a kind of science, a kind of empiricism. Yeah. Now, did anyone take a look besides Guy at Les Voleurs? The first little Burroughs essay in there. I mean, it's obvious why I stuck it in here. Right? He turns Roland Barthes, the author, into a manifesto of theft. Right. Les Voleurs, you all know what this means. Right? The thieves. The thieves. En français. Which means in French. All right. I postulate that true immortality can only be found in space. Now that is just a hilarious sentence. Come on. Right? So here's this guy trying to flesh out this idea, kind of acting as this kind of literary, bizarre poet scientist. I postulate that true immortality can only be found in space. What the hell can that sentence even mean? I want to write one sentence that good in my entire life. That insane. Right? That assertive, straightforward, and absolutely insane. Right? What could it even mean? What's he talking about? Space exploration is the only goal worth striving for. Over the hills and far away. You will know your enemies by those who attempt to block your path. Vampiric monopolists would keep you in time like their cattle. Notice again here how he invokes all these cliches. Right? All these, what are these called? Like little sayings, little adages. Right? But he deploys them in this very different way. So over the hills and far away. To grandmother's house we go. No, he's saying over the hills and far away to true immortality in outer space. Right? So he's taking this thing that's familiar and then catapulting you into the radically unfamiliar, into the alien. This is the theft he's talking about. You take things up and you repurpose them. You enter a mutation into them. You will a mutation into the known to distinctly make it unknown. Right? And then, you'll know your enemies by those who attempt to block your path. I love this triumvirate, right? So there's one, two, and then the third one. Vampiric monopolists would keep you in time like their cattle. Right? So it comes off sounding like an adage. You're like, who says that? What song is that? Is that a kid's song? Right. It's a good thing cows don't fly, they say with an evil chuckle. Evil, intelligent slave gods. The gullible, confused, and stupid pose an equal threat owing to the obstructive potential of their vast numbers. This is the world that awaits you, if you've not already met it here at UC Berkeley. The gullible, confused, and stupid. Add to that the greedy, malicious, and incompetent. You'll basically know the world in contemporary America. I had no idea. I had no idea until I got out there. It is just filled with petty, resentful little pricks, and everyone in power is a petty, resentful little prick for the most part. The overwhelming majority of people who become managers or bosses are just bad, ill-constituted people who are picked on in high school, got a whiff of power, and they're going to make you feel bad that you ever got laid for the rest of your life. Right? I'm telling you, it's all going to play itself out in this nasty way for the rest of your life. Marry rich. Know people with money already because earning it is horrible. I have an interesting slip in my scrapbook, news clipping from the Boulder Camera, picture of an old woman with a death's head, false teeth smile. She is speaking for the Women's Christian Temperance Union. We oppose child abuse, intemperance, and immortality. Hilarious, right? Clearly a typo. So here he is pulling out a scrap from an old book that he cut out randomly that in itself has a typo in it. Right? Clearly they meant to say immorality, not immortality. Right? So this essay's had a couple slips in it, right? He misquotes L. Ron Hubbard. Here are these people misquoting an assignment that he found in a scrapbook. Right? The whole point is you assemble anything, everything. That's what the artist does. You just assemble shit and try to put it together as a way of exploring what's possible in this world. The way to immortality is in space, and Christianity, buried under slag heaps of dead dogma, sniveling prayers, and empty promises, must oppose immortality in space as the counterfeit always fears and hates the real thing. Resurgent Islam, born-again Christians, creeds outworn, excess baggage, rouse meat. So here comes his argument. Immortality is prolonged future. That seems fair. Here he's deploying a nice, clean logic, right? Immortality is prolonged future. You have an infinite future. Is that fair to say? So, and the future of any artifact lies in the direction of increased flexibility, capacity for change, and ultimately mutation. So if immortality is in fact prolonged future, the way to remain constantly sort of alive in endlessly changing things is to actually endlessly be changing yourself. Right? Imagine the dinosaur who could have adapted, mutated, to live in a world that had no sun. He would have survived, right? But he didn't. He didn't adapt. So that was the end of the dinosaur. They weren't immortal. Maybe they were. Maybe they hid some of their little DNA in little buried fossils, and now we have birds and lizards and other weird things. I don't know. Right? Maybe that's a weird way to think about it. I'm not sure. But clearly, right? You see his argument. It has this beautifully hilarious, demented, thoroughly logically sound logic to it, right? If immortality is the prolonged future, well, then you got to keep changing, right? That's the key. How can you keep the future at bay? Keep adapting. Keep changing. So the way to live forever is to no longer be yourself. Is to actually be something different than yourself. To mutate. To change. Immortality may be seen as a byproduct of function, to shine in use. Right? So it's nothing, it's a nice little argument, right? So immortality is not something you just are fixed forever, but it's something you do. It's a function. Right? And in fact, to achieve immortality, you need to keep doing, changing, mutating, adapting. Mutation involves changes that are literally unimaginable from the perspective of the future mutant. Cold-blooded, non-dreaming creatures living in the comparatively weightless medium of water could not conceive of breathing air, dreaming and experiencing the force of gravity as a basic fact of life. There will be new fears like the fear of falling, new pleasures and new necessities. There are distinct advantages of living in a supportive medium like water. Mutation is not a matter of logical choices. It's a beautiful argument, right? Where you have to... You become something that you can't even imagine you could be. Right? That's the true unknown. Okay? I wrote this essay years ago that I'm still really proud of because it was back when I was smart. And it was right at the millennium, and I was working for this art.com, and we wanted to do an issue on the millennium and art. And so I tried to talk about, I don't know anything about history per se, so I tried to talk about the time of work itself. What time does it inhabit? And so I tried to think of this notion of a future art. Not what materials would be used of, but the idea of a piece of art, a work of art, that can only happen in the future. Right? And the two examples I gave were Burroughs and Nietzsche. Right? Because what's Nietzsche claims, right, he claimed someplace that he's born posthumously. Which is such a weird idea, to be born posthumously, right? You're born after you've died. Very different than Jesus rising, to be born posthumously. But the idea is that Nietzsche claims that to understand what he's written, you can no longer be yourself. You can't be human and understand what he's writing. He's writing something that is already from the perspective of the post-human, from the place in which you can no longer be yourself to make sense of it. Right? Burroughs is doing a similar thing. Right? He's literally deploying a whole literature that is all, in order to really make sense of this, you can no longer be you. It can only happen in the future when you're no longer yourself, once you've changed, once you become a mutation. Then you look back and Burroughs will just become like pedestrian literature. This will be like a magazine rather than the avant-garde, rather than this weird thing, right? In that future place where you got like gills coming out and 14 clones, right? And the world is just this beautiful Baroque, you know, a symphony of delight, this orgy of orgies. It will be, Burroughs will just be, you know, like pop literature. You'll be in a completely different place. You'll read it differently. You will no longer be yourself. The very conditions of the text are such that were you to understand it, you would be dead and reborn. It would be the future. Does that make some sense? It's a weird idea. I was very happy when I thought of this idea because it still brings me pleasure. It's like I stumbled on it and it still drives me crazy how weird it is. And the very condition, no, but I'm saying the very conditions of experiencing it eliminate you, kill you. And then you have to be reborn in order to understand it. Right? So it's not just that you experience it, it's that the terms of the experience are such that you are annihilated. Right? The very conditions of reading it are such that you can't be reading it as yourself. It can only be happening in the future. You can only be reading it as someone else, the other to yourself. And that's what Burroughs constantly deploys here. He's so much an other to himself. All these voices are riddled through him. He's deploying so many voices. Track the number of voices that are coming through here. And it's not just like a bunch of different characters in a story. It's so much freaking weirder. Right? Because they're not just characters in a story. You don't even know who's speaking. All of a sudden things are in quotes. Whose voice is that? You'll never know. It's just these voices coming through him like a possession. Right? Like he's a medium. Right, for the infinite conversations that are running through the air, and little fragments come through him. Right, you always wonder that when you see homeless guys, they're just talking, saying the most insane things. There was a guy in Philadelphia. Man, I don't know how that guy survived. He said some nasty things in the middle of a community that was not exactly supportive of him. One thing I remember he said that was one of the funnier things I remember him saying. He's a big, older white guy. Never have a shirt on. Gray hair. Kind of big. Always walking around like this. Probably 65. Who knows, because of the booze, drugs, schizophrenia, whatever. But he's like, I'm going to raise an army of lesbians and take over McDonald's. I don't know what any of that means. It was fantastic, though. He like devoted his life to comedy. But you couldn't help feeling like he was just like channeling just insane things that were just flowing through him. Snippets of newspapers, conversations. Well, I had no idea what he was talking about. Right? But it was a little like Burroughs, where he was like this medium for all these snippets of conversations. You picture if you just stand still in a place and just watch people walking by you, right? And listen to people walking by you for days. You're just going to hear snippets here and there. Just these little fragments of conversation. And then you become this weird text, this weird fabric that absorbs all these weird fragments, and then some of them come out of your mouth. And they come out of your mouth all cut together at weird angles. So that's kind of how this essay functions, right? Burroughs is already operating in this other place. Right? If Nietzsche and Bart, in a way, try to invite you into a world of dementia, Burroughs is already there. He's already post himself. He's already operating in this place that's always already conjured all the invisible voices of the world, and he's excavated himself and sprawled himself through the plays of language and the invisible world. Yep, that's what I think. Mutation is not a matter of logical choices. The human mutants must take a step into the unknown, a step that no human being has ever taken before. Right? And it's precisely this move into the unknown that I've suggested to you is what makes pedagogy, makes my job seemingly impossible. How can I get you to know something you didn't know you could know, and that upon knowing it, you will no longer be yourself? How can I get you to do that? Right? It's basically impossible. I rant, I rave, I give you the Juke Lounge show. I don't know really what else to do. That's all I can do is sort of jump up and down and yell and repeat the shit out of myself, right? And that is my main technique of violence in a way. Just repeat it, repeat it, repeat it, repeat it until you're like, you know, you're glossy-eyed. I do that, lock you in a room, feed you all a bunch of acid, and just play tapes over and over again of this crap until you like walked around. Oh, now I understand. But it is the pedagogical challenge, and it's the challenge of learning. How do you come to know something you never knew you could know, and that upon knowing it, you won't be the same? Okay? There were several junctures in my graduate experience, probably undergraduate too, but really I remember a graduate, and postgraduate, a couple times in my life, maybe three times, where I was confronted with ideas I could not understand at all. I had no freaking idea what was happening. And I was rendered absolutely incapable of reading, writing, thinking. I was like, I don't know. I don't know what's happening here. I remember sitting in a seminar, my last seminar, with Felipe Gutierrez, talking all about Deleuze and events and lightning striking. There's a repetition, this insane passage. I had no idea what was happening. I watched people talking like they knew what was happening, and I just sat there silent. Me, I sat there silently. I had never sat silently in a seminar before. So I don't know what's happening. I don't even know how to ask a question. And I know a lot of you felt this way in the course of the semester. When people tell me that, I'm like, yeah, that's a good thing. Right? Because that's the old you bottoming out. Right? And any grounds you had to make sense of something disappearing. And you have to literally grow new intellectual tendrils to grasp new things, to become a new person. So I remember after, I think it was class with Philippe, it was the end of my graduate experience. I just walked around like a moron, like bumping into things. I guess I'm stupid. I guess this is it. I guess I just reached the limit. I guess, you know, I thought I was pretty smart, but I guess I'm kind of stupid. That's just what I assumed. And I said, okay, I guess I won't write my dissertation. I don't know what to write. I can't think anything. Everything I thought seemed so hackneyed, seemed so obvious, and I couldn't understand any of these new things. I had no idea how to even get a hold of it. I didn't have that. It's not a hand you need to pick it up. Just as with uni, you don't need teeth. You got to learn to eat uni or oysters. These things that challenge how you think about food. Right? You have to use a different tool to grasp them. And so to understand these ideas, I didn't know what to do. I had to introduce mutation into myself. And through various, you know, herbal medications, I was able to grow these mutations and begin to understand Deleuze and Guattari and be reborn, and then there's no going back, right? Now I got these weird tendrils and shit hanging off of me. It's ugly. I tuck them into my pants. And what I'm trying to get you to do is grow these things, right? To take a step into the unknown and just make that step. It means you leave behind everything you knew. You don't map it back to something you knew before. You literally try to change yourself to be a new creature capable of knowing new kinds of things in new ways. That's what he's talking about here. And that, he tells you, will give you immortality. That will make your future prolonged because you'll constantly be able to adapt. Yeah. We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea. We are such stuff as dreams are made of. Who's speaking there? Why are those in quotes? By quoting someone who knows. Recent dream research has turned up a wealth of data, but no one has assembled the pieces into a workable field theory. All of a sudden, he's this very sober scientist. Right? By far the most significant discovery to emerge from precise dream research with volunteer subjects is the fact that dreams are a biological necessity for all warm-blooded animals. If you don't sleep, you die. All dreams in male subjects are accompanied by an erection. No one has proffered an explanation. It is interesting to note that a male chimpanzee who did finger and dab paintings, and was quite good too, went into a sexual frenzy during his creative acts. Cold-blooded animals do not dream. All warm-blooded creatures, including birds, do dream. What's interesting there is, what's his point? What's his point? The point is he's assembling all these different facts. Like, look, dreams, 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 dreams in all these different places. Dreams, creativity, animals. What kind of sense can we make of these? And he makes this kind of beautiful sense. John Donne discovered that dreams contain references to future time as experienced by the dreamer. He published them, And he points out that dream references relate not to the event itself, but to the time when the subject learns of the event. The dream refers to the future of the dreamer. He says that anybody who writes them down will turn up precognitive references. Dreams involve time travel. Does it follow, then, that time travel is a necessity? That is just such a beautiful moment there. Dreams are necessary. Dreams involve time travel. Time travel is necessary. That's a syllogism. He just gave you straight classical Aristotelian logic to end up in this completely demented place. Right? Does it follow? Then the time travel is a necessity. I quote from an article summarizing the discoveries of Professor Michel Duvet. Duvet, using all this stuff, was able to detect dreaming in animals in the womb and even in developing birds in the egg. He found that animals like calves and fowls who can fend for themselves immediately after birth dream a lot in the womb and relatively little after. Humans and kittens dream less in the womb and are unable to fend for themselves at birth. He concluded that human beings could not walk or feed themselves until they had enough practice in dreams. This indicates that the functions of dreams is to train the being for future conditions. I postulate that the human artifact is biologically designed for space travel, so human dreams can be seen as training for space conditions. Deprived of this vital link with our future in space, with no reason for living, we die. This is beautiful. Again, you can see dreams working through all the stuff we've read, too. The dreams introduce a fundamentally different logic. They scramble the world. They happen in a different time frame, they happen so differently than our waking life. Right? And what Burroughs is arguing here is that dreams aren't secondary to primary life, to waking life. The dreams are necessary, and that in fact dreams are this path to immortality. The dreams link you to your future and to your own mutations. Art serves the same function as dreams. Plato's Republic is a blueprint for a death camp. An alien invader or a domestic elite bent on conquest and extermination could rapidly immobilize the earth by cutting dream lines, just the way we took care of the Indians. I quote from Black Elk Speaks by John Nearhart. The nation's hoop is broken and scattered like a ring of smoke. There is no center anymore. The sacred tree is dead and all its birds are gone. For Burroughs, as for Nietzsche, art and dreams are the path to life. They are life-affirming, right? So much of science and knowledge are hell-bent on death, on exterminating the world, on exterminating life, on shutting life down, right? But that is what has precisely been at stake for these writers, right? The continuance of life, the affirmation of life rather than its relentless negation. So here's this essay on immortality that performs the blueprint to immortality, which is to mutate and become fundamentally other to yourself and openly will yourself to the place of your own proliferation and multiplicity as voices ring through you and disseminate you. That is, in fact, the path to the future. That is space travel. All right, you got to do the evaluation things. Any questions on Burroughs? Does that all make sense? Okay, a couple things. One, Thursday, I like to have class the last day, and what I've always done is just say it's open. We talk about so many things in here that I know you guys generally have questions or comments, and that Thursday I'd like to make an open day in which you can ask anything. You can turn off the little mic and everything. You ask about the department, ask about books we've read, ideas that have come up, things that have been tangential, seemingly tangential. The workplace, why late capitalism is so hell-bent on destroying all vitality on the planet. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, hold on. Let me turn this thing off. No one needs to hear this.